since I was trying to get Ramani to be, ask someone to volunteer to leave.
Yeah.
And yeah, so now we are, here, okay. So that's fine. Thank you.
Okay.
Hello. I'll just audio.
Is Sumedha Thero here? Sumedha Thero? Gilson, do you know whether Sumedha Thero is here?
I think Sumedha Thero is not here, Andy.
Maybe he can't get in either.
Yes, maybe. Yeah.
Suvinita, that's all right if no one volunteers. I don't mind leaving the.
No. Sumedha Monk is just going to welcome Ajahn.
Okay.
So maybe but you can probably.
I'm leaving. Yeah.
I think you should be leaving now. There's only 99 now.
All right.
Hello.
Hello.
I'm leaving now.
Okay, thank you very much. You're very kind. Gilson, is Sumedha Monk here now? I don't know if he's coming.
Auntie, I will call him and check.
Yeah, can you please do that? Thank you. Ajahn is just sure you are so popular, we'll have to invite you a second time.
I see.
We had the capacity of only 100 people, yes. Unfortunately. And welcome. I'm sorry we are keeping you waiting.
Yeah, that's good. It's nice that lots of people are interested. That's great. So we'll see what happens. Yeah. Can you see me okay? Is it a bit dark over here or not?
Sunita, if it's too many people, blocking the monks come, I can leave Sunita. Thank you.
If you don't mind, Lalita, that'd be good, because I think the monk hasn't been.
I'm happy to leave. He will stay. Can stay. I'm leaving. Okay.
Thank you very much, the people who are volunteering.
Pushpa.
Hello, Auntie.
Yeah.
I just talked to Sumedha Thero. He couldn't join.
Yeah.
Because of the queue.
But now he can, because one person has left, so he can get in now.
Okay, and he asked just you can introduce and just start, otherwise it will take time.
Okay.
Yeah.
Welcome, Ajahn. I'm so sorry it took so long. Now I've lost you.
You lost me?
Yeah, well, now you're there.
I'm here.
And thank you very much for being here and for your patience, unable to get into your own program. And I won't waste any more time, so I say welcome, and please start the talk. Thank you very much.
Okay. Very efficient, efficient introduction, Sweeney, so thank you for that efficiency.
Didn't want to waste your precious time. I think people are waiting to hear you, not me.
Well, that's good. That's
and they know you. I don't have to introduce you.
Yeah, good. So we'll just fire away, and we'll see what happens, see where this gets up. So I am being asked to talk today about dependent origination. So I hope you're all okay with that particular topic. Sometimes one of the things I find when I talk about this topic is it's almost as if people are afraid of dependent origination. They think it's so hard to understand and so profound that you have to be some kind of a genius. You have to have a double PhD before you can possibly understand dependent origination. But actually, it is not really true. It is possible for anyone to gain a lot of benefits from understanding this beautiful teaching. And I think the more you understand of dependent origination, the more you understand like the overall view of the Dhamma, how the Dhamma actually works, what it means to be a human being, what life is all about. And you can put together all the pieces in the puzzle, if you like. I always like to think about the Dhamma as a puzzle. And every teaching given in the Tipitaka, especially the Sutta Pitaka, is like one piece in that puzzle. And as you put all the pieces together and you get the beautiful picture and you see kind of the overall idea of what the Dhamma is about. That is ultimately what we're trying to do when you get an insight into the Four Noble Truths, when you truths, you become a stream mentor or whatever. That's what we're all, where we're all heading here. And it's a marvelous thing that this Dhamma can give rise to such profound insight into the nature of existence. And one of those insights, part of that insight, I should say, is understanding dependent origination. The Buddha says that one who understands the Dhamma sees a dependent origination. Yeah, so insight into the nature of reality actually means understanding these things. And that is why it is profound. It is profound because it relies on a very profound insight into the nature of things. And that is why it is difficult in a certain way. That is why it is something that is not, it's hard to fully understand. Yeah, this is the problem. Whereas, but we can still, even though we may not be able to fully understand it through insight, we can certainly understand a lot of that dependent origination in a more intellectual fashion by thinking about it in the right way. And that is already a very important start point. Everything in the Dhamma starts with understanding things in a rational way. And then from there, you move to more and more depth until you get experiential understanding somewhere down the track. So we shouldn't be afraid of this teaching. And I think it is very useful to consider it in quite a bit of detail. We have a bit of time today, so I'm going to go into it in a bit of detail. And hopefully that will help you to understand a bit more about what the Dhamma is about and how to practice it, how to overcome the problems and how to move towards a more meaningful and happy and fulfilling life and all of these things that we are trying to move towards. So I'm going to start off just by giving a very simple introduction to the 12 links. Yeah, for those of you, I'm sure, hopefully all of you have some idea of what dependent origination is about. And if you don't, then I will give you a quick overview right here at the beginning so that you have some idea of what we're talking about. So the idea of dependent origination is an idea of 12 factors, yeah, 12 conditions, if you like. And these conditions, they condition each other in a sequence. Yeah, so we have the first factor conditioning the second one then conditioning the third one conditioning the fourth one, all the way up to the 12th one. And it is a little bit like if you can imagine you have a series of billiard balls. And this is a very simplistic way of thinking about it. But if you have a series of billiard balls, and if you hit the first billiard ball, it hits the second, that goes, moves forward, hits the second one. The second one hits the third one, the fourth one, and then all the way up to the 12th billiard ball. In the same way, the sequence of 12 factors, each one conditions the next one. So this is a starting point. So the first of these 12 factors is known in the Pali language as avijja. And avijja means something, it can be translated in different ways, but it means something like delusion. Yeah, I think maybe literal translation, it would be unknowing, a lack of knowing, a lack of understanding of the nature of things. Sometimes translated as ignorance, but ignorance, to my mind, is not quite, doesn't quite hit the mark. Yeah. So this is the first factor. you have unknowing. You don't understand things according to reality. You are deluded. You are blind about the nature of reality, the way things actually are. And because we are blind about the nature of reality, what that means is that we think there is happiness where there is no happiness. We think that there is a permanent self where there is no permanent self. Because we have a deluded idea about reality, we go out and we try to acquire those things that we think make us happy, give us a meaningful life. And that trying to acquire things in the world, acquire status and possessions or whatever, this is the second factor of dependent origination. It's called sankhara in Pali. And sankhara means something like activities, willed activities, if you like. We go out, we will things, we do things, we acquire things, we try to create a happy existence for ourselves based on delusion. And when you try to create a happy existence for yourself, what happens is that when you live well, when you do good things, you feel good about yourself, but when you do bad things, you feel bad about yourself as a consequence. And I think this is probably something that most of you can relate to some extent. Yeah, that you know what that means. If you have good intentions in the world, you tend to feel good about yourself. If you have bad intentions, you feel bad about yourself. So how we live, all this creative activity that we do as part of sankhara, it affects our mind. It affects our consciousness. Yeah. So everything okay? So it affects your consciousness, yeah, and the level and the kind of the brightness of that consciousness of the mind that you have will depend on your activities, on how you live your life, the number of good things you do and the number of bad things you do. The more good things to do you do, the more you lift up your consciousness, the more happy, the more at ease, the more bright you feel. And the more bad things you do, you drag yourself down. So the level of your consciousness is affected by these activities, by our intentions in life. Then that level of consciousness in turn then fixes where you get reborn in the future. If your consciousness is at a high level, then you get reborn in a high realm, if you like, in a high existence. If your consciousness is dark and subdued and suppressed and pressed down, then you get reborn in a bad existence, or very often you get reborn somewhere in between, like the human realm. Yeah, so we are all kind of, human realm is actually considered a good realm, but it's one of the very first one of the most basic kind of good realms. And this is called nama rupa in Pali. Nama rupa just means like the factors of personality. Yeah, things like your body and your mental content and all of this. All of that is determined by where you are reborn. That content will be nice if you get reborn in a higher realm, and it will be much more bad if you get reborn in a bad realm. Then from nama rupa, you have the six sense bases. Yeah, so nama rupa means like the factors of personality factors. From that you have the six senses, because we experience the world through the kind of through our personality, through our personal factors, the six sense bases. And because you have six senses, you experience the world through those senses. And that is called contact, or it maybe can be sense impression. Yeah, you get impressions through your senses. And whenever there is impression through the senses, you have feelings. Yeah, the impressions like them, or you don't like them, or they're kind of neutral. And because you feel according to your senses, it means based on those feelings, you then have desires. You desire the good feelings, and you want to get rid of the bad ones. Yeah, this is called tanha in Pali. Craving is the conversion into English. And because you crave things, because you want this and you want that, then you take up things in the world. There are things in the world that you do to satisfy that craving. And those things that you do in the world, they can be either kind of ordinary, small little things, or they can be big things, like you know, the choice of a religion, for example, or, you know, what you, how you make a living and all of that is part of this called thing called upadana, which means to take things up, but quite literally. And then because you take up certain things, what happens is that as a consequence of that, then you live in a certain way, your life takes a certain shape according to all the things that you are involved in life. And that is bhava. You live a kind of existence. Very often we live a sensory or a sensual existence. Yeah, we are involved in the sensual world. The sensual world is what matters to us. And then we make karma in that world because that is where we live. And then again, that affects kind of the our inner life. And then we get reborn according to that inner life. And that is then rebirth, which is the 11th link. And because the 11th link is rebirth, of course, that rebirth then leads to old age and death. Yeah? And then that is the last factor of this dependent origination. So I don't know what that sounds like to you. Maybe for those of you who are new to dependent origination, I apologize for probably something that must sound very complicated to you, probably. For those of you who are used to it, probably it sounds okay. So how can you relate to this? And all you need to remember for now, and this is perhaps one of the most important lessons of this whole idea of dependent origination, is that it begins with delusion. Delusion is the foundation for dependent origination. And based on that delusion, at the very top comes old age and death and suffering here. Yeah, so the idea here is that if you have delusion, if you have a wrong grasp of the nature of reality, if you see things in the wrong way, then the consequences of that is that you will suffer as a human being, as an animal, as any kind of being at all. And that is how this is the main, one of the main lessons of dependent origination. So just remember that. For now, yeah, that's kind of I will come back to all of these factors once more. Yeah. But before I do that, I want to talk a little bit more generally about the idea of dependent origination. Why, what it really is about, how to think about this whole sequence of 12 factors. So one of the things that you will have noticed, I was talking about that how one thing leads to the next one. Yeah. And this idea of one thing leading to the next one, this is called conditionality. The Pali word for this is idapachayata. It means a specific conditionality because there is a specific condition that leads to a specific result. Yeah, it is always one thing that leads to something else. Yeah, and this is kind of the point about this whole dependent origination. So the idea then is that if you have delusion at the beginning, you must have the other factors. From delusion comes all these willed activities. Yeah? From the willed activities comes consciousness. And each one of these things arise as a consequence of delusion at the beginning. You have no choice in the matter. If you are deluded, all of these things must arise, ending up with suffering at the end. If you are deluded, you will have to suffer. There is no two ways about it. That is what this is saying here. So this is the idea of conditionality here. Like one thing must lead to the next one. But there is a very important corollary, or you can say the opposite way of thinking about this. And that is that if you end delusion, if you go into the reverse of the sequence, whereby you end the first one, and then and then that ending actually also makes itself felt through the whole sequence. So when you end one, the second one must end there. When you end the second one, the third one must end. Yeah, when you end the third one, etc., it goes all the way up to the 12th one, which is the factor of suffering. So every one of these factors sees as a consequence, starting with the first one, going to the end one. Yeah, so if you are able to make an end of delusion, you know that you're going to make an end of suffering. That is what this is about. So that is the positive thing. Yeah, this is the thing you can actually be really happy about. You can think, yay, I can make an end of suffering. Hooray. You can be happy. You can find the meaning of life, the purpose of all existence. I can find the highest happiness in the world. This is what the Buddha promised. Is it? All we have to do is to get rid of illusion. Yeah, that's all. So It is, of course, getting rid of the illusion is not necessarily all that easy. This is, of course, the problem here. So, but that is really what it is about. And this is what this path shows us, that we need to overturn delusion. Of course, the good news is that if you understand the Noble Eightfold Path, that is exactly what the Noble Eightfold Path is for. The purpose of the Noble Eightfold Path is to overturn delusion. It is to give rise to understanding, to insight. That is the purpose. So once you understand how this connects together, all you have to do is practice the Noble Eightfold Path fully. And as you do that, then delusion will be overturned. And when it is overturned, then everything ceases. And suffering is gone as a consequence. This is the promise of dependent origination. A wonderful thing, isn't it? It's a marvelous promise. And it's when we look at it in detail in a second, you will start to see how it all comes together very beautifully here, and how it all makes sense in a very nice way here. But it's a fantastic thing. And this is kind of what makes the Buddhist teaching so interesting and exciting. It has a very realistic way of thinking about the human condition, the idea of suffering and happiness, of how it can be dealt with, why it exists. Yeah, and dependent origination is one of these beautiful gems of Buddhism that shows you how this whole thing comes about. Yeah, it's a very kind of complete doctrine in many ways, the Buddhist doctrine, in terms of showing us the nature of existence. So that is the idea of conditionality. Now, one of the things that I want to point out about dependent origination, very often the question arises, is dependent origination, is it about what happens now in this life? All of these links, are they kind of, delusion, then you have consciousness and you have all of these things. Does everything happen kind of now, immediately? Is it something you can see with insight happening in one life? Or is it about something that happens over many lives? This is one of the arguments that you will often find, and you find this on the internet, people arguing about this until they are blue in the face. Or whatever it is that you become when you argue too much, I'm not sure what you become. Maybe red in the face if you argue, you get too angry. But so this is the problem, yeah? So what is it? And this actually matters enormously, because one of the things that you find when you start to read the word of the Buddha, the suttas as they're called, is that it is full of the idea of rebirth. Rebirth is a fundamental aspect of the Dhamma, the teachings of the Buddha. So what is dependent origination? So to understand the dependent origination from a slightly different viewpoint, one of the interesting things is to go to the Four Noble Truths. So in the Four Noble Truths, you find that the second noble truth is the truth of the origin of suffering, the Dukkha Samudaya. Dukkha Samudaya. Samudaya means origin, and Dukkha is that suffering here. Now, that origin of suffering is explained quite simply in the suttas. It says that it is this craving here, which has to do with rebirth. Porno Bhavika means to do with again existence. Tatra Katra Abhinandini. It finds delight here and there. Nandiraga Sahagata. It comes with delight and desire. And sayatida, that is to say, kamatanha, bhavatanha, and vibhavatanha. So the purpose of this second noble truth is very simple. It shows you the cause of suffering, dukkha samudaya. And that cause is tanha. Tanha is a craving, But it is a very specific kind of tanha. It's the porno bhavika tanha, the rebirth causing craving. That is the second noble truth. The second noble truth links three things together. It links craving, it links with rebirth, and then with suffering. Craving, rebirth, and suffering are the three main aspects of the second noble truth. So why is this interesting? Well, it is very interesting because when you look at the 12 factors of dependent origination, suttas, which show you that there is an alternative way of defining the second noble truth. The second noble truth, sometimes, instead of having what I just said now about craving and rebirth and suffering, sometimes it puts dependent origination in there instead. Yes, the whole 12 factors of dependent origination that I just mentioned, those 12 factors are then put there instead of the ordinary sequence of three factors that we find in the second noble truth. So in other words, dependent origination is just an alternative for the ordinary way of expressing the second noble truth. So what that means is that if we are dealing with dependent origination, we can be absolutely sure that it must have to do with rebirth. Yeah? Because second noble truth is about rebirth. If the dependent origination expresses the second noble truth, that too must have to do with rebirth. So in a sense, we are closing things nicely in there. Now, there is an extra additional thing which is interesting about this. And what is interesting is that dependent origination is or sometimes expressed in slightly different ways in the suttas. Sometimes it is 12 links. Usually it is 12 links. Sometimes it is only 10 factors. Yeah, maybe the first two are missing. Sometimes you find 9 factors. Sometimes you find 7 or 6 or 5. Sometimes you find it starts with craving and then goes from craving to taking up to existence, rebirth, to old age and death. That's what you find sometimes. Yeah. So the question then is, how many factors do you actually require to have dependent origination? If it comes in so many different types and forms, at what point is it no longer called dependent origination? What if you have one factor? What if you only have old age and death? Is that dependent origination? And the answer is obviously no, yeah, because nothing is originating. All we have is one factor. What if you have just birth and old age and death? Is that called dependent origination? And again, the answer must be no. There's nothing really originating there. So the answer to this question, I think it is, and it's a very important question, is that something can be considered dependent origination if it fulfills the factors of the second noble truth that I mentioned before. It has to include craving, rebirth, and suffering. If it has those three things, then you know it is expressing dependent origination. And this is very important because it means that then when you read the suttas, you have some idea when you are encountering dependent origination and when you are not. So to give you an example from the suttas, very often in the sutta, for those of you who are familiar, I do apologize if I lose some of you because sometimes you have to go into a little bit of detail to make it, to make these things kind of interesting and broad in a sense. Now, in the suttas, one of the very interesting things that you find is what is called the sequence of perception, how human perception works. Yeah, and the Buddha often says you have the eye and then the visible object. So when you have the eye and form, or eye or the visible object, if you like it, then the consciousness arises based on that. Yeah, you see it because there is eye and because there is the object of the eye. Then the consciousness comes in. It's called eye consciousness because it's based on the eye. Then when those three come together, you have the eye, you have the object, you have consciousness. Those three coming together is called sense impression, or it's called contact, usually called contact in the sutra, in translation. But I think sense impression might be a better translation. And when you have sense impression, then you have feeling. Yeah, and when you have feeling, then you perceive the world. And there's a famous sutta which says that from the perception you have thought, from the thought you have proliferation, known as papancha in the Pali language. Yeah, and from papancha you then have papancha sanyasanka, which is a further development of that papancha, the proliferation, and all of these things. And now some people who say that this, which is a very interesting sequence, by the way, it's very interesting because it shows how we function psychologically. We create all of these things in our minds. Yeah, we build up these worlds inside from the sense impression, and we think about it, and we proliferate, and we make it into mind, and we crave for it, and we make it into an ego, and we have conceits about it, superiority conceit, inferiority conceit, equality conceit. It's one of those beautiful Buddhist ideas, equality conceit. That's kind of very, very Buddhist equality conceit. I don't think anyone else in the world has the idea of equality conceit. So we are kind of special in this particular Buddhist particular idea. So it is all very interesting. But some people say this is dependent origination. And the reason they say it is dependent origination is because it is a sequence, yeah? A sequence of things, one arising after the other. But that is not enough. That is not enough to call it dependent origination. The point I was making just before is that for it to be called dependent origination, it has to include craving, rebirth, and suffering. Yeah, if it doesn't have those three, it cannot be called dependent origination. So this is one of the wonderful ways of actually being able to filter out some of the commentaries that you hear, is to be able to remember this when you read the, if you ever do read the suttas, that is a core of what dependent origination is about. Without that, it is not really called paticca-samuppada or dependent origination. And if you want to know, there are lots of other reasons as well why dependent origination is about many lives and not one life. Yeah, it is about two lives, three lives, four, and how many lives you want, but it's not about one life or one moment or moment to moment or anything like that. So there's lots of reasons for that. One of the reasons for that is that if you look at the definition of this word that I translate as rebirth, yeah, the definition, this word is called jati in Pali. The definition of that is always the kind of the acquisition of the five khandhas, the sense faces, being born into the world, coming into existence, and all of these kind of things. So it's very clear that it means birth or coming
into existence. I'm sorry, Ajahn, I'm going to interrupt you here. I think I have to ask other people who have got their mics unmuted to mute their mics because it's affecting the sound.
Yeah. Okay, so please, everyone, mute your mics, everyone, and so that there won't be any problems. There should be an icon at the bottom of the screen, at the very left corner at the bottom of the screen. You can mute your mic down there, just by pressing that little icon down there. Okay. So there are a large number of reasons why it is about many lives, not one lifetime. And I've just given you one, a very important one. And I'll give you a few more just to kind of make it very clear to you that this is what it is about. I just mentioned before that dependent origination is about how delusion ends up with suffering. Yeah. Now, one of the main ways that suffering is described in the suttas, it is always described as the round of rebirth, how you go from one life to another one. There are some very famous similes in the suttas about the number of lives that we have lived, the number of tears that we have cried is more than the water in the four oceans, and all of these kind of terrible similes. Don't think too much about those similes because you might get really depressed. Okay? So be careful not to get depressed, because if you get too depressed, that doesn't really help you at all in terms of your meditation practice. In fact, it has a negative consequence. So be very careful how you use the Dhamma. Use it wisely. It was very interesting. I was speaking to a man recently, an American man. He was asking for some guidance about Dhamma and meditation practice. And he told me that he had very large problems with depression. Yeah, sometimes he would go to bed and he wouldn't get out of bed for 2 months. Yeah, he was just lying in bed for 2 months. He couldn't move, couldn't do anything yet. And then he would kind of come out of his depression, and then he would be very happy for a while, and meditation would be going really well, and bang, the depression would come back again and last for another 2 months. And his last 10 years of his life had been like that. What an unpleasant state. And he told me recently that he thought he had figured out the problem. And the problem was, he said, that he had spent too much time thinking about these negative aspects of the Dhamma, too much time on thinking about, you know, we have cried more water than there is water in the four oceans. That's a lot of water. Yeah. I once tried to calculate, I was going to calculate how much water that is. If you cry and you have a tear, how much water is there in one tear? not much, right? Very tiny amount. And then you compare that to sort of water in the all the oceans of the world. And then you find out how many tears it is. And it's a lot of tears, yeah? Billions and billions and trillions of tears that you have to cry. And of course, if you think too much like that, you do get depressed. Yeah, how can you not get depressed? You think, oh, and he told me, he thought, what's the point of living? What's the point of doing anything at all? Life is just so terrible. And then you lie there, and you lie there for 2 months. You can't get up because you feel so terrible about everything. Please don't make that mistake. Don't take the Dhamma in this way, because if you do that, it will have very negative consequences because of that. So don't use these things wisely. But the point is that in the end, this is what suffering is about. Yeah, this is why we say in the first noble truth, we say, Panch Upadana Kanda Dukkha, the five aspects of personality, that what we are as human beings, that is dukkha. What that means is that when you carry on in rebirth, on and on and on, you are perpetuating dukkha, you're perpetuating suffering because of that. And so, because dependent origination is about how suffering arises, it has to affect that aspect of reality. Otherwise, it is not suffering here. Otherwise, it's not, doesn't really give you the solution to suffering here. Yeah, so this is another very important reason why it is this. I could give you a number of other reasons. I could tell you that in the Buddhist history, almost all schools of Buddhism, all the commentaries, everything there is, will tell you that this is all about rebirth, dependent origination. And I could give you some other rational reasons as well, but I will leave it at that, because otherwise we're just going to be talking about these reasons for the rest of the day. But so it is, to my mind, it is very clear that this is what the Buddha was talking about. Yeah, there is no kind of, we don't need any modern interpretation of this. The ancient interpretation, is here, a very powerful and strong one. It's important that we realize the wisdom sometimes of the people of ancient times. It is very easy to think that in the modern world we are far more advanced and we have our technology is much better. But it's good to be humble as well. It's good to realize our own limitations. And I think that sometimes when it comes to wisdom, for example, when it comes down to insight into reality, a lot of the time, some of the ancients were actually probably wiser than we are today. Why? Well, because they had very good supporting conditions for that wisdom. They had a society that valued someone else. They had a society where people did samadhi practice. They had a society where all of these things were possible. And it is not so obvious in much of the modern world how you would live in that way. It's much more difficult. In Australia today, or in large parts of the world elsewhere as well, it is not so obvious. So this is the first point I would want to make about the kind of broad outlook of dependent origination. It is really about the second noble truth, and it concerns rebirth. The second point I would like to mention briefly is the fact that dependent origination is also, you need to understand a little bit about the Brahmanical and Vedic background. The Brahmanical, the Brahmins were the kind of the priests, the religious priests at that time, and they were the kind of the strongest religion before Buddhism arose in India. And it's important to remember that when the Buddha spoke, he very often spoke to counter some of the Brahmanical teachings. Yeah, the Buddha lived in a certain context, and that context was ancient Indian society. It included certain religions, it included certain political structures, like certain countries and kings and all of these kind of things. It included a certain language that was used. And the Buddha had to react to these things. He had to use these things. And he had to, if he was going to argue against an existing view, he would have to use that view and talk about it. So he would have to talk about the Brahmanical religion. The Brahmanical religion is the precursor to modern day Hinduism in India, but it's a much simpler and quite different type of teaching. So this is important to understand, because there are some very strange things in Patipsa Samuppada. And You may have, when I just talked to you just now, you may have, when I mentioned the 12 links, the 12 factors before, things like nama, rupa, name and form, yeah? It's a very strange thing. Why is the Buddha talking about name and form? It doesn't really fit with any other Buddhist teachings. And to be able to understand why the Buddha uses the word like name and form, you actually have to understand the background, the religious background in India at the time. These are words you find in the Brahmanical literature, the Vedas. The Vedas are what actually existed in India before Buddha came along. And you have to refer to them to understand what is going on. And many of these factors, like Te Vidya, or rather Vidya, for example, at the beginning you find in the Brahmanical literature, has its own meaning for the Brahmins. Things like Tanha and Upadana. Yeah, Upadana means fuel. This is one of the meanings also in Buddhism, yeah, that you find there. And so all of this is what you then kind of comes together when you study this in the right way, and then you actually have a you start to understand dependent origination, because you have the background to be able to assess what is going on. So having said all that, I want to now, I'm going to go through the sequence one more time. And I'm going to go through it a little bit more slowly than last time, so as to give you a little bit more understanding. And I will try to also bring in some practical examples, how to think about this so you can actually use it in your own practice. And you can make, you can actually, not, it's not just a theoretical thing, but you can think about it in such a way that you can apply it in your daily life, in your meditation, in the way you think about the world, etc., etc. So back to avijja again. Avijja is at the very beginning of the sequence of 12 factors. Yeah, and the way it is explained here, it is explained as a delusion or lack of understanding of the Four Noble Truths. Yeah, so if you don't understand the Four Noble Truths, what does that mean? It means that you don't understand suffering, the cause of suffering, the ending of suffering, and the path that leads to the end of suffering. Yeah? These are the things you don't understand. Now, if you don't understand suffering, suffering is the first one here. This is maybe the most important one in a certain way. If you don't understand suffering, it also means that you don't understand happiness. Yeah, because these happiness and suffering are two sides of the same coin. If you understand one, you must understand the other. If you don't understand one, you also cannot understand the other. So it means that we are deluded about suffering and happiness in the world. We don't know what to pursue. We don't know what is right or what is wrong to pursue in the world. We have a misunderstanding, a misconception of these basic things. Yeah? So this is a very important point. But it is not just suffering, because one of the things about suffering is that it always comes together with also the other, these are called the tilakana, the three characteristics. This is how to understand what it means to be a person, yeah? Everything in the world comes with these three characteristics. So once you, if you don't understand happiness and suffering, actually it means you also don't understand the idea of non-self. Yeah, this is the most fundamental and the ideas in Buddhism, is the idea that actually there is no self in this world. We perceive that there is a self. We perceive that there is a core person, I am somebody real. But actually when you look at it deeply enough with real wisdom, you see that existence is empty. There is nothing there in the ultimate final analysis that you can grasp as yourself. Yeah, and then the third one of these three characteristics is the idea of impermanence. Yeah, everything in the world is always changing. Yeah? Nothing can ever be held onto. Yeah? Everything will always be kind of, you try to grasp it, but as soon as you try to grasp it, it's going to be pulled out of your grasp. Why? Because things are, by the very nature, impermanent and unreliable. Yeah? So these are the three things I want to take as the basis for understanding the idea of avijja, of ignorance or delusion. Yeah, we don't understand happiness and suffering. Yeah? We think that things are far more permanent than they actually are. Things are really quite impermanent in the world. We think they are much more permanent. And the last one is that we tend to take things to be a self. We see some inherent personality inside of us that is always there, when actually things are really non-self. Things are always changing. There's nothing there we can grasp on as the kind of final I, the final me. So what does it mean when we have these wrong ideas? And what it means is that when we, because we have the wrong idea of where happiness and suffering, we try to get hold of happiness. When we try to get hold of happiness, very often we are looking in the wrong place. Yeah, what we are looking for, we are looking for happiness, but actually we end up finding suffering instead because we're looking in the wrong place. Yeah, so we think that there is happiness in the world. We think that there is happiness in enjoying ourselves, in messing around, in, you know, having in kind of all, whatever kind of sensual pleasure that it is that you get involved in. We think it's wonderful to have, of course, a partner in life and maybe lots of children and large family. And if you are a grandparent, to have grandchildren is so important, right? I'm sure some of you are grandparents as well. And people love to have grandchildren. Yeah, this is how they often are. So all of these things, yeah. And of course, status is so important in life. Everyone wants to have status. You want to kind of climb the social hierarchy. You want to do really well at work. All of these kind of things. And this is where we think happiness is. Of course, sometimes we have a little bit of doubt. Yeah, are we really looking in the right place? Sometimes we're a bit uncertain. That is where a little bit of right view kind of shines the light, yeah, shines the light into the dark corners and shows us kind of a little bit about the right way. But then not too much as we come back, this idea of finding happiness in worldly things again. And this is the problem, yeah. We're looking for happiness in the wrong place. And because we're looking for happiness in that wrong place, we go out into the world and we try to create that happiness. That act of creating that happiness is what sankhara is all about. You can call sankhara, if you like, you can call it creation, because we are creating, yeah, or you can call it creating, maybe, or you can call it willed activities, or you can call it intention, yeah, you can call it what else can we call it? The making of things, the building up of things. Yeah, this is all what sankhara is about. The idea of sankhara, independent origination, only has that very simple meaning. The idea of willing things, of having intentions and trying to create happiness in the world. So what do we do? We go out, we try to find a partner. Yeah, we go out, we have a job, we work really hard to build up our bank account, to make sure that we have enough money, not just to survive, but to enjoy ourselves as well. And then we do kind of, you know, we try to get a nice car and have a nice house and all of these kind of things. And these activities, this pursuit of the sensual pleasures, that is what sankhara is about. Intending, moving in that direction, trying to build it up again and again and again. That motivation, that drive towards finding that happiness, that is the building up of sankhara. And so I just mentioned that so you can now see how, you know, when you have the view that happiness is to be found in the world, then you build up sankharas on that basis. But it's not just the wrong idea of where happiness is to be found, but it's also the idea of having a sense of self. Yeah, because that sense of self, what it tells you that you have power to do this thing. Yay, I'm the doer. Let me do. I'm going to go out in the world and do lots of things because it feels like you are empowered. It feels like you can create that happiness. Yeah. All you have to do is get the interest of that person that you are so interested in. You have to kind of do the right thing or whatever it is. All you have to do is work hard enough and build up or whatever. It is up to you to create this. It feels like you are empowered. You are the creator. Yeah. Of your own existence, your own life. So you go out and you do things because you feel empowered. And the last one is the idea of having the wrong idea that things are much more permanent than they actually are. It feels like when you create these things, it feels like they will last for a while. It feels like when you create a nice home, a nice family, it will be like that. Yeah, for the rest of your life, that's what we often think. We forget that divorce happens to most people these days. We forget that people die in the meantime. But it feels like it's going to last for a long time. They have a nice family. Everyone is kind of working together in harmony. And everything is nice. But of course, yeah, but it isn't quite like that. But that is the idea in our minds. And so what happens then, because of this misperception, we start creating and doing things, we pursue things, we do good actions, yeah, we do good things. And as we, because sometimes when you are pursuing a relationship or whatever it is, you are kind to other people, because kindness is the right thing to do. Yeah, so you act with kindness because you want to attract the nice partner in life. You are kind to them. But at other times in our pursuit of the things of the world, we actually do bad things. Yeah? For example, if there is like if you are a child, yeah, someone else wants the same partner that you have, then you have a conflict of interest. And sometimes if you are the wrong kind of character, you might do something nasty. You might do something unpleasant. You want to get that rival out of, yeah? You see these things in the world all the time, how rivalry between people, two men interested in the same woman or two women interested in the same man, and then or two people fighting for the same promotion, yeah? Or two children fighting for the same piece of cake or whatever it is. There's so much rivalry in the world. And that rivalry often leads us to do bad acts. Yeah, so in the pursuit of all of these sensual pleasures, we sometimes do good things, sometimes we do bad things. And this is the idea of sankhara, how we do a mixture of good and bad. And as we do that, that affects our minds. Yeah, the more we do of the bad things, the more dark our minds become. It drags us down, do a lot of bad things. It has a very negative consequence on your mind. And after a while, you feel a lot of remorse. You feel really bad about yourself. You feel, oh, why am I doing all of these things? And you blame yourself and all of these kinds of things. On the other hand, when you do good things, you have the opposite feeling. You feel, hey, I'm living well. I'm doing the right thing. My life is okay. My life is good. So there's a balance between these two factors. And then, so the sankharas, in other words, affects your consciousness. The more good things you do, the more it lifts your consciousness up. The brighter it is, the less things you do, press your consciousness, put it down, crush it down into a dark hole. And that is how your actions, the sankharas, affect consciousness directly, the brightness of that consciousness. Yeah, and of course, then what happens is that because your consciousness is either lifted up or lifted down, and at the end of your life, and the sum total of all those actions that you have done, all the sankharas that you have done, they will, the sum of all of those things will decide the level of your consciousness. You've done a lot of good things. Consciousness will be in a high place, in a bright place. And then when you die, it goes to a good existence in accordance with that. If, on the other hand, your consciousness is dragged down by all your bad actions, then when you die, you go to a place accordingly. That is how you end up in a bad destination in the future. And for a lot of people, it's somewhere in the middle. Yeah, it's somewhere in the middle because we do some bad, some good. And then we kind of end up somewhere in the middle, like in the human realm. And that is the idea of Nama Rupa, is where you end up in this particular place. So that is the basic idea of the first three or four factors of dependent origination. Yeah, and I hope that makes some sense to you. But what I want to do now is I want to backtrack again. I want to go back to the very beginning, to the idea of avidya, of ignorance and delusion. Because I want to ask, well, how can we, what is it that we actually want to do here? What happens if we, if instead of just accepting the avijja and delusion at the beginning, what if we start a spiritual practice and we start to undermine the avijja, the delusion? We start to build up more wisdom instead, more clarity, more vipassana, more clear seeing. And we don't just allow things to be the way they are. What if we start to become more spiritual people? So if avijja is the problem, how do we eliminate that avijja? And the answer to that is that avijja itself is said to be supported by other factors in turn. Yeah, and you can take this back a long, long way, and you can say the ultimate cause of the problem is because you don't have good spiritual teachings. You haven't been, you haven't hung around the Buddha enough. Is that right? Are you hanging around the Buddha enough? You need to hang around the Buddha more. Yeah, this is the point. So what does it mean to hang around the Buddha? Well, it means that you read the suttas. You read the word of the Buddha. You try to understand what the Buddha was teaching. That's what it means today to hang out with the Buddha. The Buddha bequeathed all of these beautiful teachings to us. He gave these teachings to humanity. He taught them 2,500 years ago, but they are still just as valid today as they were 2,500 years ago. Let's use these teachings. Let's hang out with the Buddha. When you are reading these teachings, actually, you are in the presence of the Buddha. Yeah, he's teaching you right there and then. What a marvelous thing that is when you think like that. So it goes all the way back to the to not listening enough to the Buddha. But the main reason why illusion, the more immediate reason, is that we have the five hindrances in the mind. Yeah, the five hindrances are the things that lead the mind astray, lead it in the wrong direction. And this is a very standard set of factors that you see in the suttas, and most Buddhists will have heard of many times already. These are, of course, the hindrances of sensual desire, of ill will, of dullness and lethargy, something like that, of restlessness and having remorse. And the last one is doubt. Yeah. So the answer then is, if you want to reduce delusion, you have to reduce these five hindrances. How do you reduce the five hindrances? Well, in the end, it is about the Noble Eightfold Path. How do you practice the Noble Eightfold Path? By listening to the Buddha, by understanding dependent origination, yeah? All of these things. That is how you start to get into this this path. You just have to allow yourself to be brainwashed a little bit by these beautiful teachings. Now the brainwashing cleans out your brain and cleans out your mind. And gradually, each one of us, we become more pure. That's kind of the idea with it. So you work on these defilements. And as you work on these defilements of the mind, by being kind, by being caring in this world, by helping, looking after each other, by speaking to each other in a kind and caring way, by thinking words of kindness to each other. Yeah, it's all obvious when you think about it, but it's just difficult to do, to be consistently kind. But that is really the holy grail of Buddhism, is to be consistently kind. And if you do that, then the five hindrances gradually, they go down. And as the five hindrances go down, lo and behold, avijja, delusion, ignorance, unknowing, all of that goes down at the same time. Isn't that marvelous? This is how it works. Yeah, you're actually reducing delusion simply by being kind in the world. Be kind and you are less deluded. Yeah, everyone can be kind. It means that everyone can be less deluded, yeah, by just being more kind. It's such a marvelous thing. It's so simple when it comes down to it, isn't it? It is so, you know, it is, there's nothing kind of magical about it. It's magic in a certain sense. This kind of marvelous kind of magic that is going on. But it is not difficult, even though dependent origination may seem hard. What you have to do is very simple. Come back to kindness. Come back to looking after around you. Care. Be kind to yourself as well. And then as you do that, then all of this starts to happen in a very marvelous way. And you become a more good seeing being. And all of these things happen. Of course, it takes time. Of course, you need to persevere. You need to be consistent. You need to commit to these things. But doing that, it actually works in a beautiful way. And then as the delusion, the avijja at the very beginning of dependent origination, as that goes down, it affects how you think about life. Instead of thinking about the importance of sensual pleasures, the importance of status, the importance of being successful, the importance of being famous, the importance of all of these kind of things, instead of thinking about that being the most important thing in the world, what you do instead, you start to realize that actually there are other things that really lead to happiness. Kindness leads to happiness in a much deeper way than any kind of sensual pleasures or objects of the status and all of these kind of things. A much more reliable and solid kind of happiness that you get from being kind and caring and thinking about people with metta and compassion and even doing some meditation practice. That is where real happiness, the deep happiness, the solid one that goes deep into the mind, deep in the heart, that is where it comes from. You start to realize that because you start to reflect upon the reality in the world in a new way. And as you do that, your sankharas change. You're no longer so concerned about the sensual world. So if someone, you know, is going to challenge you at work and they're going to say, yeah, I want the promotion, not you, you're not going to do bad things to get that promotion. You're not going to argue with somebody over a piece of food. You're not going to argue with someone even over a potential partner. Yeah, you're going to, okay, let it go. I'm not going to take it so seriously. And you look at life in an entirely new way because you value new things. You stop doing the bad things. You do more good things. And as you do that, as the sankharas, your creations in the world are about the positive things rather than the bad things, you are starting to lift up your mind. You feel better about yourself. Your consciousness brightens up. Yeah, it starts to become more luminous. You feel some transformation happening deep inside of you. And this is your mind changing. Your consciousness is becoming more bright, more beautiful, more powerful. Yeah, it is lifting up. And you can almost feel inside of you moving towards a better rebirth in the future. A good mind feels better. You know it's going to have a good result. You know it's going to move towards a positive place in the future. That is how this works. Yeah, so the avijja goes down. The way you intend to live your life, the way you create happiness for yourself is now different. You're doing more positive things. You're lifting up your consciousness. And then eventually when you die in a higher place as a consequence. The nama rupa, the personality factors are different because you are being reborn in a higher place. And this is how it goes on. Yeah? The more you reduce those defilements, there comes a time eventually when you realize that actually all of this doing is a waste of time. Because the doing is the opposed to the peace of meditation practice. So there comes a point when you calm down all the doing. You go into a state of deep samadhi instead. And in that state of deep samadhi, the mind is entirely, fully purified from the five hindrances. And at that point, you're not doing anything anymore. You realize that all doing was silly in the first place. All doing had no purpose. Yeah. And this is where you start to understand the very meaning of life, the very profundity of the Dhamma. Because if doing is a problem, then there comes a point, eventually, when you carry on with this one, you get enough insight that you stop all doing altogether. And you never do, you never create anything anymore because you do not want to create a future because there is a problem there. And there is no happiness to be had there anyway. So all creative activities, they all come to an end. And that is where the path changes from the path which builds up, yeah? When you're building up, it moves forward, one thing leading to another one. Suddenly now, things start to cease instead. Avijja is ceasing because now you understand the nature of the world. There is no self there. There is no happiness to be had in this particular anyway. Ceasing, ending things is far superior. That is where real peace and real ending of suffering is to be had. And because of that, you don't try to create a future for yourself. And because you don't try to create a future for yourself, the consciousness no longer has any kind of level. The idea of level relates to a particular kind of existence. But if you don't want to exist at all, if you don't in rebirth, we are left on. Consciousness is no longer in the world. It withdraws from all, any kind of rebirth, any kind of future existence. And this is where consciousness, if it doesn't move towards a future existence, if it doesn't grasp on to Nama Rupa, if there's nothing, nowhere for the consciousness to go, then consciousness must cease. And this is the cessation mode of dependent origination. And it is what, I don't know what it sounds like to you. Maybe it sounds like, you know, it sounds very kind of strange and very weird. But remember, this is how the Buddha explains the idea of happiness. When you have insight, you stop trying to create a future which is not really there for you anyway. This is how it works. So, I don't know. I hope you are, hope that is, you're okay with that, and that is not too, I haven't gone too far in my trying to explain how dependent origination works. But that gives you a very short, a brief idea of the first three or four factors of dependent origination, how they build up and how they cease. And there's a lot more that could be said about this. I could expand on this for hours and hours because really there's a lot of detail that could be used to flesh it out a bit with it, because it is a very important and very interesting teaching, but hopefully it gives you a rough idea of what is happening here. So let us continue a little forward and also take into account the other factors of these 12 factors. So once your consciousness then has a certain level, let's say that you have lived a very good life, yeah? Because you have lived a very good life, then when you die, your consciousness is stationed in a high place. This is actually a Pali word for the station of the consciousness. The vijnana titti is the word for this in Pali. And when your consciousness is stationed in a high place when you die, it continues in that high place in your next life. Yeah, this is how it works. Kind of one thing moving on to the next one. And because you then get reborn in the corresponding high place, what that means is that you then have certain experiences. Yeah, that's what it means to be reborn in the heavenly realm, for example. The reborn in the heavenly realm means that you have mostly happy feelings. You have nice perception. Yeah, you see beautiful things around you. You hear beautiful heavenly sounds. You eat beautiful heavenly food and all of these kind of things. Yeah, so you have perceptions and feelings that are different. Your will is different. Now you are willing towards these positive objects around you. Your body, what you look like is going to be different. Everything is going to be shaped by your rebirth. And this is the idea of Nama Rupa, the idea of the what your personality, what your individuality is like when you get reborn in a new existence. And it is the same if you then get reborn in a bad existence. Yeah, if you do many bad things in your life, and then you get reborn maybe as an animal, maybe a kangaroo in Australia. I don't know what you think about that, being reborn as a kangaroo, but I wouldn't recommend it. Yeah, I know sometimes it looks like the kangaroos are very cute and very sweet or whatever, but actually kangaroo life is pretty miserable. Yeah. I live out in the bush, I see the kangaroos all the time. It's pretty miserable life. I would not recommend it. So I hope you agree with that. So then you have kangaroo existence. And when you have a kangaroo existence, you have a kangaroo body. This is the kangaroo rupa of Nama Rupa. You think like a kangaroo. I'm not sure what they think, but you know, you kind of crave a lot, yeah? And when you feel the kangaroo feelings, you eat grass, very boring, you don't have very many exciting tastes, and you perceive the world from a kangaroo perspective. So your individuality becomes a kangaroo individuality. So depending on where you are reborn, Nama Rupa, all these factors of individuality depend then on where your consciousness has been stationed. That is how it works. Yeah. So that is kind of the idea behind this. Nama Rupa here really means all the other factors of a human being apart from consciousness. Consciousness is what gets you there. All the other factors of who you are is what Nama Rupa is about. But there's something very profound going on here, and it may not be very obvious to you. And the reason why the Buddha uses the word Nama Rupa, it is not very obvious at all. Yeah, but the reason is because Nama Rupa is, as I mentioned before, it is a word that is used in the ancient Vedas of the Brahmins. Go back to the ancient Brahmanical texts, the Vedas. They use the word Namarupa to mean individuality. Yeah, who you are as an individual person. Why? Because you have a form as a person and you have a name. A name and form defines you as a person. That makes you who you are. It individuates you. It sets you apart from the rest of the world. Yeah? And this is a very important point for the Vedas, because if this is what makes you an individual, if you want to get rid of that individual, the individual is like the Atman, yeah, the self. If you want to get rid of that coarse Atman and you want to unify with the world, the mind, like Brahma, or, you know, the larger, the kind of larger Atman of the world, if you want to unify with that, you have to get rid of the personal individuation, who you are as a person. You have to get rid of the you, the me, the I, yeah, the Nama Rupa, basically. And then when you get rid of the Nama Rupa, then you merge with the world soul, the world spirit, and Brahma. This is the Brahmanical idea. So the Buddha uses this word Namarupa to make a very important point. In the Brahmanical teaching, you get rid of Namarupa, and when you get rid of Namarupa, you find the Brahma, you find the world spirit, the world mind. But the Buddha is saying, no, it isn't like that. Because the Buddha is saying that Namarupa depends on Vijnana. And he says in another discourse, which is very interesting as well, this is called the Mahanidana Sutta, Digha Nikaya 15, the long discourse, the Buddha number 15, not only does Nama Rupa depend on consciousness, consciousness depends on Nama Rupa, on name and form. These two things are mutually dependent. They lean on each other. Yeah. So if you take away name and form, right, the Brahmins are saying that if you take away name and form, then you find the world spirit. The Buddha says, no, it's not like that. If you take away name and form, consciousness, yeah, which here is kind of the Buddha's way of talking about a similar kind of idea like the world spirit, consciousness too stops. Consciousness cannot exist without name and form. And name and form, if you take away the consciousness, name and form collapses. These are mutually dependent entities. There can be no consciousness without name and form, without the other factors of personality, the body, or the other mental content that we have. And this is revolutionary. Yeah, this goes to the very core of what Buddhism is about. And this is the revolution that the Buddha started in India at that time, because he pointed out that this whole idea, world, mind, actually, it is impossible, because the mind or consciousness exists independently from Nama Rupa. It depends on that. If you take Nama Rupa, you don't get the world mind. What you get is cessation, consciousness to an end. So this is one of the most crucial and critical things about dependent origination, the thing that makes Buddhism into Buddhism. This is actually really what makes Buddhism what it is. And without this core idea, which really is the same as the idea of non-self and all of that, there wouldn't really be any Buddhism. Buddhism wouldn't be what it actually is. This is the critical thing that makes Buddhism what it is. And again, talked about in the other suttas in more detail. There's one very famous sutta called the Kacchanagotta Sutta, found in the Nidana Sangita number 15, which talks about this relationship in much more detail. And it's considered by many one of the most interesting and profound suttas, perhaps, because it talks about these things in a very interesting way. So anyway, I will leave that for now, just for you to kind of be aware of that, because it is not, it takes a lot of time to talk about this in great detail. So once then you have been reborn in a new existence, you have achieved your individuality through name and form, through nama rupa, then the next thing, because you exist in that new realm, of course part of that existence includes the six senses, yeah? So you experience the world through the six senses. When you experience the world through the six senses, then there is sense impression. Yeah, the senses are impacted by the external objects. So you have sense impressions. And because you have sense impressions, you feel the world. This is called Vedana in Pali. And you experience those sense impressions either as positive or as negative. Yeah, either you like them or you don't like them. And this idea of Vedana, the idea of sensation or feeling, whatever you want to call it, it is also another very important aspect of the Buddhist path. Because Vedana, or feeling, whether something is good or bad, this is the critical thing that drives us in life. This is what gives life meaning. This is what gives life purpose. Yeah? If you try to imagine a life where things didn't have any, didn't feel anything, when you couldn't make any difference between whether something was good or bad, whether it was pleasant or unpleasant, and if you weren't able to make that distinction, nothing would have any meaning anymore. The reason why we are motivated to do anything is because it has some meaning to us, some purpose. We'll have some positive outcome down the track. Reduction of suffering, perhaps, increase of happiness, whatever it is. Yeah, that is why we pursue it. So feeling is one of those very critical factors in Buddhism. And this is one of the reasons why the contemplation of feeling is a very important part of the path. Because if you understand that these feelings are out of control, if you understand that these feelings, you cannot really, you know, this, you cannot control them in any way, then also the meaning of life also is out of control. The purpose of existence is out of control. You cannot fulfill any particular purpose because it is just impossible to control. So for that reason, contemplation of feelings is something that you see a lot in the suttas. The understanding, you cannot have the feelings that you want. You cannot find true meaning merely by pursuing positive feelings and avoiding the bad ones. But once that reality is there, and once the you have feelings, then for most people the natural thing then is to crave, to desire. You want the good feelings, you want to avoid the bad ones. Yeah, this is just how it works in the world. And craving then arises as a consequence of those feelings. And this is something that all of you, I'm sure, you can see. Yeah, you can see this straight away, that something is really delightful and you want more of it. And something is terrible and you want to go get away from it. This is just the nature of the human mind. This is how we are, you know, how we work in this life. It doesn't matter where you come from or where you are. We're all like that. Animals are like that. Ghosts are like that. Heavenly beings are like that. It's very hard to find anyone who's not like that. So, save because of these feelings. Now, one of the very important aspects of the Buddhist path happens right here in the juncture between feeling and craving. Yeah, because craving is something that we're trying to overcome. Remember the second noble truth, I talked about that before. Craving is the cause of suffering. So you want to overcome that craving to some extent, yeah, at least reduce it a little bit. And this is where we do that. We start reducing the craving by observing the effects, how craving is caused by feelings. And then we can start to restrain. We can understand that there is a problem here. All this craving just leads to endless running around, endless problems. And by a certain degree of restraint, by stopping certain cravings, etc., etc., you then withdraw a little bit from that craving in the world, pull back from that, because you understand the problem of craving. Yeah. This is where the restraint comes in, the understanding of the problem of craving. Yeah, it happens at this particular point. But it is also important to understand that you cannot actually stop craving merely by restraint. that sometimes you hear the argument that what you need to do is all you have to do is to be mindful at this particular point. So, yeah, you are mindful about what's happening in your mind. And as you are mindful, then you stop craving in its tracks. And eventually that will lead to the complete ending of craving. But actually, that is impossible. You cannot end the craving merely by restraint. And this is the whole purpose of dependent origination, is to show that if you want to end craving, if you want to stop this perpetual running around after things that are ultimately empty and not meaningful, you have to go back to the beginning of dependent origination, which is the illusion. That is where you resolve the problem. You don't resolve the problem at the point of craving. You just resolve it at the point of delusion. You undo delusion. Then the problem is resolved. So craving, the connection between feeling and craving, what we should do here is to restrain ourselves. Try to reduce the craving a little bit, because you cannot get rid of delusion if craving is very strong here. So we reduce craving, we have sense restraint, we understand that certain kinds of craving are really bad, we try to live lives that are moral and kind and all of these kinds of things. Part of that is craving. And as you reduce craving, this means that the hindrances are going down. Yeah, I talked about the hindrances before. When the hindrances go down, it means that you have more understanding, more vijja, more wisdom at the beginning. And because you have more wisdom, then you can take craving down even further, until eventually craving is so far down, all the five hindrances are gone. And when the five hindrances are gone, that is when you can overturn avijja, and you can actually see things according to reality for the first time. So that is the purpose of this link between feeling and craving. Not to end the cycle there, but to aid you to overcome avijja at the very beginning. Okay, let me just finish off the last few factors fairly quickly, and then we can go over to a few questions afterwards. So when you crave, then you take things up in the world. This is upadana, literally means uptake, the grasping hold of things, yeah, the uptake of things. And this is, for example, you know, when you take up like a relationship, or you take up a certain view, yeah, Buddhism is best, yeah? Do you all agree with the best? Maybe you don't do, maybe I'm not sure, maybe you do. But this is kind of, obviously, we would all think Buddhism is pretty good, otherwise we wouldn't be Buddhists, presumably. Yeah, so Buddhism is good, that's kind of taking up a certain view, you take something up, or you take up a relationships, and all of these kind of things that we do. We take up living in a house, an education, a job, and whatever it is, we get into a certain lifestyle. And the reason we do that is because we think it will satisfy the craving. Yeah. So once you have craving, you try to satisfy it. You take things up. This upadana is also called fuel in the sutta. It fuels the rebirth. It fuels your, when you take these things up, it fuels your movement forward, yeah, into new lives in the future. So when you take up all of these things, yeah, whatever it is, and this will vary enormous, a bit from person to person, what we take up, then your life has a certain direction. Yeah, you live in a certain way. You live embedded in the sensual world, for example. Because you are embedded in the sensual world, it means that you make sensual karma. Yeah? And how do you know? And this link, by the way, is called bhava. This is the 10th link in dependent origination. How do you know what that bhava is, that existence is, that life direction that you have? How do you know what it is? You exist in a certain way, yeah? Your mind likes to hang out in a certain way. What is that? And one of the ways to find out about that is just to see that when you go on a meditation retreat or in meditation, yeah, even in ordinary life, you see, where does your mind tend? Does your mind tend to think about sexuality and problems of the life or whatever? Where does your mind lead towards the peace and the quiet of meditation? That is how you know where your bhava, your existence is, yeah? Where the mind likes to hang out in this very life. And then when your bhava when you exist in a certain way, again, you get reborn in accordance with that. Just as I mentioned before, where your level of consciousness, you get reborn. This time we call it existence instead. You get reborn accordingly. This is jati. The best translation for jati is rebirth and not birth. Yeah, and this is another kind of interesting point. We often call birth, but actually it really means when consciousness arises in a new existence. And there's many good reasons why it means rebirth and not birth. And that is actually, I think, a fairly significant point. And then because you are reborn, you become old and die. Yeah? And because you become old and die, all the other factors of existence, the sorrow, lamentation, pain and despair, whatever happens in your ordinary life, all that comes along. And then the Buddha said, in this way, the whole mass of suffering arises as a consequence of that. Yeah, everything comes into existence. So the very last factor is really old age and death. And I just want to make that point. And this is, I think, a very interesting point in some ways, that the last of these 12 factors, it is not actually suffering. Yeah. Suffering is implied, of course, but actually it is specifically said to be old age and death. Why is it old age and death? Why doesn't it say suffering? Because it is about the cause of suffering, right? And this is a very interesting point, because what it means that old age and death is like the thing that summarizes the idea of suffering. It is how we can approach and come to understand what suffering really is about in our own life. If you read from the Sutta, rebirth is suffering, living in all of these different realms is suffering, being reborn here and there is suffering, all of that, it is not something that we can relate to very easily. Another life is very theoretical to us. But old age and death is something every one of us can understand. Yeah, and that, I think, is one of the reasons why the Buddha makes such a fuss out of old age and death. He actually makes it into the last factor of dependent origination. Yeah, it is almost standing in the place of dukkha, of suffering, of the problem of existence. Because if you understand old age and death properly, you have a very thorough understanding of what of the nature of suffering itself. And the more I look at the suttas, the more I see that this is true in so many different places. If you look at the Buddha, when the Buddha went forth, yeah, the Buddha decided to try to find the end of suffering. What was it that drove the Buddha to seek the end of suffering? Old age and death. Yeah, again, the same problem again. So it is almost as if the reason why we have Buddhism today is because there was a man, the man who later became the Buddha. He thought about old age and death in a very profound way, and that is what enabled him to become the Buddha. That is how powerful it is. So it is an extraordinarily powerful thing, and has driven Buddhism for such a long time. It is at the end of dependent origination. It is found in the first noble truth. Yeah, the first three factors of the first noble truth is birth, old age, and death. Sometimes birth, illness, old age, and death. Yeah. So again, right at the beginning, it is found throughout the sutras as a very important conversation for everyone to remember the idea of age and death. So it is surprising how fundamental this is to the entire teaching. So if you want to understand the idea of suffering, of course you can think about the idea of rebirth, but probably more useful, and I would really recommend you to do this, remember the idea of dying, because dying is such a powerful moment in human existence. It is a moment when you have to give up almost everything in your life. And having to give up almost everything, it can be very difficult unless you are prepared for it. Yeah, when you have to give up your belongings, all the beloved people in your life, all your friends and everyone, even so much of your mental content, can be very, very hard unless you are ready for it. So use that beautiful idea of death contemplation to remind you that. And what it does, if you use that, it actually helps you to undermine the hindrances. It helps you to become a better person. It helps you to reduce those things at the very beginning of the dependent origination that helps you to become wiser, just the illusion, and become a better person. And as you reflect on the last factor of dependent origination in the right way, as you think about this with wisdom, then avijja, the very first factor, starts to become less. And as that becomes lesser, it makes its way felt all the way through the sequence. And gradually, you are on track to reducing all of these problems. And as you reduce these problems, avijja at the very beginning, eventually you eliminate it. And then you have solved the whole problem. Thinking about the last factor, you undermine the first one. And by undermining the first one, eventually you get the very last factor as well, including all in life. Okay, so I have been talking for a long time, and so I'm going to stop there, and I'm going to allow Sweeney to say a few things, if you'd like to say something, Sweeney, and I will come back to the Q&A afterwards.
Yes, please, Ajahn. Firstly, please forgive me for not welcoming you in the proper manner, but I was conscious of the time, and I thought, oh, anyway, it is so great to see you again, even if it is only online. I should say thanks to COVID-19. Otherwise, we would have lost you to the world of your followers. As we witnessed tonight, I think the people who got in tonight, it would have been like winning a lottery ticket. And I'm sorry to those people who are trying to get in and they just couldn't. And I think next time I just have to find a Zoom facility that would accommodate 500 or more people when you come to give a talk, Ajahn. So I think you'll have to come again. And thank you and many blessings for being with us tonight, Ajahn, and for your excellent, meaningful and insightful Dhamma talk on this very profound and difficult subject. It made me think about my make-believe life like Alice in Wonderland, how I have constructed this me, mine, and myself with these 12 links of the dependent origination and created my own mass of suffering. I also thought all I have to do to stop this suffering is to use the tool Lord Buddha gave us, the Noble Eightfold Path, to break at least just one of the links of the dependent origination. But the fool that I am, I still can't fully break them because I have glued myself to them to feed my tanha. Not much different from a kangaroo, I guess. And thank you and many blessings, Ajahn. May this gift of your Dhamma Dana be a paramita to you. And before I hand over to the audience to ask questions of you, I would like to thank Venerable Sumedha Thero and his committee for your support and for giving me your Zoom facility, and all the friends who helped me in so many different ways, and especially the audience for being here tonight. And my apologies once again to all of you who couldn't get in. I will let you ask the questions now. And thank you very much, everyone, and many blessings. And may you always be safe and happy. Thank you once again, Ajahn. Bless you.
Thank you so much, Winnie. There is quite a few questions in the chat group already. So maybe I can just go on to those so I will just have a look at it. But quite a few people saying hello, so hello everyone. It's nice to see many old friends, many few of you from overseas, and what a wonderful thing it is to see you all there. That's great. I'm not going to mention your names or anything in case you don't want to have your name mentioned, but it's nice to have you see you all again. Let me just see, so if you have a question, maybe the best thing to do is to actually write it in the chat function. The first one is from Bobby in Malaysia. Hello, Bobby. Nice to see you here. And your question is, dear Ajahn, there are some monks inside that there is rebirth, no ghost spirit, saying it's all in the mind. Yeah, they may say that, but I think that it contradicts the Buddha's teachings, and I think it contradicts what you see in the suttas. And I think that if you really want to understand Buddhism, you have to try to understand what the Buddha taught. The Buddha is, I think it's fair to say that the Buddha is number one expert on Buddhism. Yeah? If the Buddha doesn't know what he's talking about, then we are in serious trouble. Yeah? Then it's not going to work out. So we have to assume the Buddha got it right. We have to assume the Buddha has some real insight. Otherwise, nothing really works out. So, we just need to go back to the suttas. Rebirth is everywhere. Dependent origination is about rebirth. And this has been true for the history of Buddhism. We look at the commentaries, we look at the different schools, we look at Mahayana Buddhism, we look at the definition of a jati, which is birth or rebirth, the way it is defined in the suttas. Everything revolves. It revolves around that. It's one of the very core aspects of Buddhism. It is fascinating. Sometimes you see people trying to take rebirth out of Buddhism. And what the consequence of that is that you have to rewrite almost all of the Buddhist teachings. Because all the Buddhist teachings are somehow involved with rebirth. Yeah? Suddenly the Four Noble Truths become very different. And I recently heard one very famous author, I'm not going to mention his name, but a famous author who calls himself a Buddhist, but he doesn't believe in rebirth. And he said that recently he has also stopped believing in the Four Noble Truths. Yeah. And I thought, gee, if you don't believe in the Four Noble Truths, what is left? The Four Noble Truth is like the container for all the good teachings of the Buddha. If you don't believe in that, then I don't really see how you can even remotely call yourself a Buddhist anymore. And the consequences, the reason why he got to that point is because he stopped believing in rebirth. And when you stop believing in rebirth, then suddenly the idea that craving leads to suffering via rebirth, it doesn't make any sense anymore. Yeah? These things completely fall apart. The idea of the First Noble Truth, which is also about rebirth, because that's what it means, jati in the First Noble Truth. The Third Noble Truth, which is about the ending of rebirth, everything falls apart and you end up having to throw out the Four Noble Truths. Then you have to redefine dependent origination. Then you have to redefine the end of the path, the purpose of the path, which is said to be the end of rebirth. So everything becomes turned upside down once you throw out one of the pillars of Buddhism. Rebirth really is one of the pillars. You pull that out, the whole house comes falling down like it is made of a pack of cards. It works out anymore now. So thank you, Bobby, and thanks for that question. And so let's move on. Let me have a look at the next one. The next one is Irene R. The balance between nonchalance and indifference. How can we be detached and compassionate at the same time? Okay, so the idea of detachment is really just the idea that you have more clarity about what you're doing. Yeah, to be attached means to have the vested interest in something. So to give you an example, I don't know if you are a mother or you probably are a daughter at the very least. Yeah, I really. So because you have some relation to the people around you, they do will impact you. Yeah, if you have a child, for example, if your child misbehaves, it makes you feel bad because it is your child. You have a vested interest in the behavior of your child. That is what attachment is. Attachment is that vested interest in how other people live. And as long as you have vested interest, you cannot see things clearly. You're not able to see what is the greatest benefit for your child. What you see is also your own vested interest. What is good for you? What is important for you? Yeah. So because of that, you are actually not as good as making good decisions as you would be if you were more detached, were able to stand back more and allow your child to be what is in the best interest of the child. You can see these parents are often very pushy with their children. They want their children to do well at school. Is that because of the well-being of the child? Or is it because the parents want to be proud of their child? It's a bit of both, right? It's a bit of both coming at the same time. But very often it's because you want to be proud of your child. That's an important part of it. But if you purely look at the happiness of your child, usually we would bring them up in a different way. We would give them a lot of kindness, a lot of care, a lot of compassion. We would tell the child, it doesn't matter what you become. Yeah, you can become an ordinary person if you want to. You can become a plumber, or if you want to become an engineer, that's fine, but you can become a plumber or a lawyer or whatever. It doesn't matter. I'm going to love you. I'm going to look after you. I'm going to care for you, regardless of what you do in your life. And that is really the ideal way of looking after somebody. You look after their happiness, and you try not to be so vested in the outcome of things. Detachment is something that comes naturally. It's not something that you can force. It comes naturally as you develop the path. Don't try to be detached. Allow the detachment to arise as you practice the path. And part of that practice is itself compassion. And that's why you can be compassionate and detached at the same time. Okay. The next question is from Indira. Hello, Indira. Dear Ajahn, consciousness brings nama rupa, new birth. Craving brings existence, new birth. Yes. And the idea is that the way that the information is structured, yeah, it is often structured into like a three lifetime sequence. This, you don't, shouldn't take this as too strict. Yeah, three lifetime is just a nice way of kind of dividing it up. It doesn't mean that dependent origination is just about three lifetimes. It's also about 2 or 4 or 100 or 1,000 lifetimes. But that is how the Buddha has kind of laid it out, just to clarify how it functions. Yeah. So there's two places in the sense where rebirth is looked at in dependent origination. And these two places look at rebirth from slightly different angles. And that is why I think the Buddha does this, because it gives us slightly different information, slightly different angle on how to approach this problem. And if you have different angles, it enables you to understand what is going on much better. This is kind of the idea behind this. Yeah. So you, the more angles you have, and this is why sometimes it can be nice to listen to, look at different suttas, maybe sometimes even listen to slightly different teachers, as long as you know what they're talking about. And then as you do that, you put together and you start to understand how these things work. Yeah. So, I think I've talked enough about it already, but that is kind of, I think, why we find this thing this particular way. Okay, so let me go on to the next one. So this is, hi Ajahn, much blessing on your talk. I would like to know, when do you truly know nama rupa understanding? And if so, is it all about sotapatipala? So sotapatipala is the time when you become a stream enterer. So it's the first time you see the Dhamma properly. And that is right, when fully understanding nama rupa, and also, which is name and form and consciousness, that happens when you become a stream enterer. Yeah? That is when you see the Dhamma, as I mentioned before. Yeah? If you can, yeah, okay. Okay, so yeah, so it all happens at stream entry, because that is the time when you have an insight into the Dhamma. That's when you open, get the Dhamma eye, the Dhamma chakku opens up, and you understand reality for the first time fully. Yeah, and that is equivalent to the seeing into dependent origination. It is mentioned in several places that dependent origination is that the opening of the Dhamma eye, the seeing of things according to reality. That is why it is so profound. And remember, the core thing that you see when you see dependent origination, the one thing that really matters is you see how craving gives rise to rebirth. Yeah, this is going back to the second noble truth again. So you see how craving gives rise to rebirth. You see the power of craving. You see its ability to build things up in the future. And based on that, all the other factors of dependent origination come into place based on that idea. So when you have a consciousness that is imbued with craving, then Nama Rupa is established in a certain existence as a consequence of it. Okay, many little notes of thanks here. It's very nice, many people saying thank you, wonderful. And then we have another question here. This, thank you, Bhante, the question. We are a new person at the molecular level at every instant as cells multiply and replicate and die. Is it our attachment to karma that prevents us from realizing this emptiness and impact? Yes, that is basically true. It is our craving for the body, the craving for the five khandhas, the craving for our person that stops us from understanding the emptiness of phenomena, yeah, and how there is nothing really there to hold onto. The body just isn't that interesting. Especially when your meditation starts to get deeper, you start to get some more happiness and bliss in meditation. Actually, you start to understand that body is a big pain in the proverbial bottom. Yeah, it is not really worth it. And so yes, attachment is one of the biggest problems here. That's why you cannot actually see things. So you need to let go of that attachment gradually, and as you gradually get rid of the attachment and the craving, then eventually, as the five hindrances disappear, then you will be able to see these things in the right way. Thank you, Ajahn, and the organizers. Attachment to Nama Rupa is attachment to conceit of self. Are there specific elements of Nama Rupa to let go of? There is a gradual path of letting go, yeah, and you have to follow that path gradually. You cannot really let go of things in the preferred order. You have to do it gradually because there are certain things that are easier to let go of than others. And one of the most simple things to let go of the body. Yeah, you start letting go of the body, and this actually happens in meditation practice. And the best way to let go is actually to do it through meditation practice. If you look at suttas like the Sutta on the Mindfulness of Breathing, the Anapanasati Sutta, you will see from the Anapanasati Sutta that what is happening there is actually gradual letting go of things. You are simplifying things more and more, leaving more and more things behind until eventually you read a state of samadhi. And the state of samadhi is actually a state of having let go of enormous amounts of things. So it takes a lot of wisdom to be able to reach samadhi because you have to let go of a lot to even get there. And I think people often forget this, that wisdom and samadhi are just two sides of the same coin. The Buddha actually says that, the famous verse in the Dhammapada, which says there is no wisdom without jhana, there is no jhana without wisdom. But one who has both wisdom and jhana, they are in the presence of nibbana, a famous verse from the Dhammapada. So you let go gradually, and you do this especially through your meditation practice, when you can see that the more peaceful you are, the more you have let go. That's how you find out. And the things that you let go of are, actually, they are Nama Rupa. Yeah, that's what they are, because that is all we ever let go of, are the factors of personality, if you like. Yeah. Okay. So the next one is from Singapore, from Joyce. Thank you, Ajahn. If a human being sees non-self, do you have rebirth? Does rebirth occur? And the answer to that is that if you see non-self fully, remember that non-self can be seen gradually, yes, stage by stage, because this is actually what happens in meditation practice. As you detach, as a previous question said, you're actually abandoning things. And those things that you abandon, they are then understood to be non-self. Otherwise, you couldn't abandon it. So you see non-self also gradually, stage by stage, yeah, slowly, slowly. And one of the things that you realize, and this is the beauty of the path, is that the more you see non-self, the happier you feel. Yeah? You know what I mean? When you become peaceful in meditation, your thoughts are dying down, your body is gradually disappearing. How do you feel? And the answer is you feel really good. Yeah, you feel really happy when this happens. And that's how you start to understand and how you start to know that non-self is a very positive and very delightful thing, because the more you abandon, the more wonderful you feel. And eventually the penny drops. So that actually, if I see non-self fully, then it will be a very, very good consequence, because seeing it partly gives so many benefits, and seeing it fully will surely give even more benefits. Okay, then we have Bobby again. So, dear Ajahn, while watching movies and serial dramas filled with violence leave lasting negative imprints in our minds. the best thing to do is just to find it out for yourself. Yeah, see how much you think about that violence and those movies afterwards. And in my experience, it does often leave an impact. Yeah, you watch something, and sometimes I watch things because I might be visiting my family or something, and you happen to watch something. And often it leaves an impact, at least for a while afterwards. Not very long, perhaps, but at least for a while. So, just watch out and try to find out what works for you. Don't live a life which is completely boring and terrible. It's okay to have some entertainment, of course. It's important that we enjoy ourselves in this world. Otherwise, it would be really have a really terrible life. But try to be wise about it. Look at the impact it has. Yeah, and the more you see it for yourself, the impact, the easier it is to let go of, because it just becomes, you understand that it is driving you in the wrong direction. We need to be motivated from inside rather than to be motivated from the outside. So it's really a self-understanding that is the most powerful thing. Okay. Then I will just go down. There's more thank you notes here, which is wonderful. And then we have next question is, Vante, can you please explain what's the living in the present moment means? What does it mean to live in the present moment? And what it means is just that sometimes we are, we dream about the past, we dream about the future. Yeah, when you're walking along, you're not really walking along, you are somewhere in your head thinking about other things. So being in the present moment means that when you are walking along, you actually know what you're doing. I am here walking along. You feel the weather. You feel the feet hitting the ground. You know what is happening on around you. If you meet somebody, you're ready to greet them because you are in the present moment. In other words, you are here. And of course, being in the present moment is actually important. It is important because it allows you to react in the right way. It allows you to react with kindness. When you are in the present moment, it gives you the opportunity to choose your own reactions. If you are somewhere in your head, if you are fantasizing about something or whatever it is, then suddenly you meet somebody and you react without really being able to react appropriately. Your reaction is automatic. And because your reaction is automatic, sometimes it will be good, sometimes it will be bad, but you are out of control. And this is one of the reasons why it is useful to be in the present moment, because it allows you to react, to live well, to be kind and careful and be ethical. Yeah, this is one of the main reasons why you want to do this. Okay, good. That is everyone. More thank yous from everyone down there. What a wonderful thing that is. So I wish you all well. May you all enjoy the Dhamma and continue practicing well and be kind and caring for each other. We still have a COVID situation around us. What a wonderful opportunity that is to practice the Dhamma sometimes, to have the COVID around us. So use this opportunity well. Don't think of it as something terrible. It is just part of the path. I wish you all well. Look after each other and keep on living in a good way. Goodbye for now.
Thank you,
Ajahn. Thank you, and many blessings, Ajahn.
Thank you, Ajahn.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Thank you, Suvinita. Thank you.
My pleasure. And I'm glad you were able to get in.
Thank you, Suvi. Thank you.
Thank you, Sinita.
You're welcome. I'm glad you were able to get in.
Thank you, Sinita. Keep up with the good work.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Everyone.
Thank you so much, Sister Terry.
Thank you, Sweeney. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you for being here.
Yeah, I do. Thank you.